everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I may be hobbled, but I'll still get on the radio. Lots going on. We spent yesterday talking about how it came to pass that Planned Parenthood started providing a full panoply of healthcare options to women this past Monday. If you don't get how we got there, yesterday's show will explain all of that to you. And I also explained about the technicalities of the legal interpretation that the judge engaged in order to come to that conclusion that, in fact, there is no 1849 abortion ban. And I promised yesterday that I would also explain the technical legal interpretations that's going on with the current Megan Wolf scandal with the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Just to bring everybody up to speed, here is the scoop. Megan Wolf has been the elections commissioner since, I believe, 2016. It's a nonpartisan position. She was appointed and confirmed by the Senate. She oversaw the 2020 election. Obviously, some factions of the GOP seem to think that there were election irregularities, which there were not at any scale to impact any outcome. So says basically all of the people in the know from the Trump administration itself, as well as all of the courts that have reviewed the various challenges to the election outcome. But notwithstanding that, the GOP wants to remove Megan Wolf as yet another symbol of distraction and continued whittling away and indulgence of the MAGA fiction that there's something wrong with our election system. So they want her gone, and her term was up this past summer. So the question became, like, is the Wisconsin Election Commission going to renominate Ms. Wolf for confirmation by the Senate? Now, the Wisconsin Elections Commission is comprised of three Democrats and three Republicans in short form. They're nominated and placed on the Wisconsin Elections Commission through various mechanisms, but that's the upshot of it. Three Republicans, three Dems. Well, when it came time to decide on Megan Wolf's renomination to the position of elections director for the Elections Commission, the three Republicans voted to forward her appointment to the Senate for confirmation. But the three Democrats abstained. That led to a 3-3 tie, effectively, which does not meet the Wisconsin statutory standard to make an appointment by the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which requires a majority, which would be four members of the commission. One might ask yourself, why is it that the Democrats abstained? Well, because they knew that the Senate would reject her renomination, and they believed that that was not in the best interests of Wisconsin elections processes. They also abstained because a decision from the then Republican-controlled Wisconsin Supreme Court just a few years ago, and in fact, not years, just last year, issued on June 29th, 2022, said that under factual and statutory circumstances that are almost and functionally identical to those that apply to Ms. Wolf, a holdover member of the then DNR board, a man by the name of Frederick Preen, was not required to step down, or because his term had ended, a 6-year term had ended, had expired, that the expiration of his term also did not create a vacancy. And so Governor Evers could not actually seat anyone of his choosing on the DNR board. Why am I going into all this detail? Well, because facts and technical interpretations matter. If you have more questions about this after I get done with this little explainer, call us up. I can talk about this one all day long, but I'm going to keep it to this A block because I served up a whole bunch of technical interpretations yesterday. So, of course, if you've got more questions, 844-967-2789, you can text or call us. But here's the rub. Under Wisconsin law, when someone is appointed for a specific term, say 6 years in the case of a DNR board member, that was Mr. Preen, or in the Megan Wolf case, a 4-year term as elections director, absent specific statutory language that indicates that a vacancy occurs at the expiration of their term, There is no vacancy. And if there's no vacancy, there's no need, there's no ability for the governor to reappoint or to have the governor's chosen person take the seat. Now, in the case of Mr. Preen, because he wouldn't step down, while it was the case that Governor Evers had appointed a replacement, the other statutory requirement to seat that new commissioner had not occurred. And that was the consent of the Senate. And back when it was about a DNR board member, the Senate simply refused to schedule the confirmation hearings. Now, Mr. Preen was just the tip of the spear. They did this with a lot of Governor Evers' appointments during his first term. So the Supreme Court read the statutory language regarding Mr. Preen. And they, in my opinion, came to the correct legal conclusion that until there is a vacancy, there is no ability for the governor to force his appointment or his appointee to take the seat. And what was going on there was that the Senate was refusing to act. Okay? So to summarize the facts in Mr. Preen's case, an appointment had been made by the governor, but the Senate refused to meet to confirm the appointment or to reject it. And so Mr. Preen continued to sit. Supreme Court ruling, yes, he continues to sit in that position as a holdover. Now we turn to Ms. Wolf. So the three Democrats on the Wisconsin Election Commission don't vote to reappoint her. So there is no appointment that has been made by the appointing authority. That's one of the differences with the DNR board case that came down in 2022. There, the governor had made an appointment. The Senate refused to act. And so Mr. Preen, a Walker appointee, continued to hold that seat. In Megan Wolf's case, there's no appointment because the statutory prerequisite for the appointment to be made, that is a majority of the Wisconsin Elections Commission makes a recommendation of the appointment, has not occurred. Nonetheless, and despite the Senate's own legislative counsel who wrote a memo saying there's nothing for you guys to have a hearing about because there is no appointment for you to consider, convened a hearing last week and effectively tried to fire Megan Wolf. So what is the technicality here that matters? The technicality here is that when the statutes don't say that a vacancy is created at the end of a specified term, there isn't one. Just as like a parallel to the fact that under state statute, Ms. Wolf has not been reappointed until a majority of the election commissioners actually make the appointment. My argument is that the decisions need to remain consistent. But the thing that is sort of roiling around in the background here is, boy, this seems to all run pretty counter to common sense, doesn't it? Like, why would the governor have to continue with a prior governor's appointment to a really important board? Why would abstaining, when you're the Wisconsin Election Commission members, why would that be okay when you're not fulfilling the statutory requirements to make the appointment? So here's what the scoop is. The common sense problem here is the good faith and the obligations of the state Senate to, in fact, hold confirmation hearings and to actually take people on their merits. So in the case of Mr. Preen, the Senate failed to do what its statutory mandate is, and that is that they shall provide advice and consent as to the nominee, and they were refusing to do so. And in fact, the Supreme Court's decision, which many Democrats attacked and assailed, and in fact drew dissents from all of the court's liberal wing at the time, I disagree with those criticisms. The Republican majority of the Supreme Court interpreted with the Wisconsin statutes correctly. But what the people that were opposing Mr. Preen failed to notice was that the Supreme Court left a crumb trail in the opinion. And that was file a lawsuit to try to force the Senate to actually take up the appointment. Here, in the case of Ms. Wolf, it is ironic because now the Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Lemahieu, is arguing that the Wisconsin Elections Commission is mandated under state statute to make the appointment, that they must find someone that they can recommend to the Senate with a majority of the election commission. But the reality here is, if it's good for the goose, it should be good for the gander as well. And there's simply not an intellectual, even a hint at consistency in the Republican position between how they treated Mr. Preen and their obligations under statute to convene and hold confirmation hearings for a governor's appointments. That's all I really wanted to say about it. Again, all of this relies on good, careful, close, technical interpretations of the law, just as yesterday's discussion of the abortion decision and the Dobbs case that is proceeding in Dane County Circuit Court. So understanding how courts assess these issues is quite important. And judges following the law, following the canons of statutory instructions, fairly and consistently reading technical statutes, sometimes means decisions won't go the way that your party wants. I was disappointed to see the dissents from the liberal wing of the Supreme Court on Mr. Preen's appointment or continuing holdover seat with the DNR board, because they were wrong on the law. Again, this should not be an outcome predetermined whether you're a Republican or a Democrat way of hearing cases. You have to look to the statutes. You have to read them carefully. So I hope that with a new liberal majority on the court, that cases are not viewed from an outcome determinative standpoint. We need the court to return to careful and technical and consistent interpretations of the law. That's it for the school lessons today. If you've got more questions about the Megan Wolf fiasco, you can call us up. But I'm going to be moving on. I got to talk about Fetterman, since the Devils were all fired up about the hoodies and, you know, athletic leisure wear in the U.S. Senate. So join us for that conversation when we come back. I got a whole grab bag of stuff that we got to touch upon. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. We're doing a grab bag today because one segment of technical stuff was all I could take this afternoon. You can join our conversation. If there's something that's top of mind for you, please call me, 844-967-2789. But I wanted to start with the debate over Senate dress codes, because I kind of have a bit of a nuanced view here. So the Devils were talking about this at the end of last hour. Let's just set it up. The Senate and the House for years have had dress codes. They've evolved over time. At many points in time in the past, they've been quite strict. Women have to wear skirts. Women have to wear, can't have bare shoulders, no open toes. You got to wear pantyhose. Most of it, if you want to guess, like the longer portions of the dress code are always about what women are wearing, because heavens to Betsy, I might be able to discern a woman's body shape through her professional clothes. You know, some of that. But suffice it to say, just this past week, Charles Schumer, head of the Senate, the majority leader for the Democrats, changed the dress code. And in effect, he said in a statement, the long and short of it is senators can wear whatever they want on the Senate floor. And so Fetterman, the newly minted senator from Pennsylvania, ended up showing up on the Senate floor with a hoodie, gym shorts, and gym shoes on to take a vote. And of course, the conservative wing went bananas. They have lost their minds over this. How dare he? It's a disgrace to the Senate. So I wanted to hear what you all think. And it sounded like many of you had some pretty very particular perspectives that you were sharing. But I also wanted to share mine because I have worked in a whole lot of different places, in a lot of different environments. I've worked at a Wall Street white shoe law firm. I have worked for a federal judge. I have worked in federal court. I have worked in state courts, both in New York, Illinois, and Wisconsin. I have been in many a legislative chamber. I am going to be part of the county board's meeting tomorrow. That is a legislative session. I could go on. You name a conference room experience, I've been there. Here's what I think. You shouldn't wear gym shorts and a hoodie. You shouldn't. But the idea of whether or not an individual elects, should be able to elect to do so, and whether or not they believe that that's appropriate for whatever business is occurring that day, I tend to sort of lean on that side of things. Now, I will offer you this perspective. If you're just going in there to push the button when your name is called in a vote, I don't care if you wear gym shorts and a hoodie. If a foreign dignitary is coming to address a joint session of Congress, if it is the president's State of the Union, if there is a lengthy and contentious debate that is about to occur on the Senate floor, if the Senate, you know, is convening an impeachment trial of a president, put on a suit and tie. So I don't care that Fetterman wore a hoodie and gym shorts to go cast a vote. If you're in and out of the Senate floor just to do that, that's not a big deal. The only people watching are the folks that watch C-SPAN all day and call in when they take callers. And boy, if you haven't had a chuckle in a while, tune into some C-SPAN in the middle of the day. Whoa. But the point that I wanted to make is this. The only people in this world who can dress like slobs when they go to work are people who have power and authority. And most frequently, those people look more like John Fetterman and less like me. You get my drift? If I showed up in any of the roles that I just described to you all, in gym shorts and a hoodie, I wouldn't have gotten the job. I would have gotten fired from the job. I have been lambasted by a federal court judge in New York for not wearing a skirt. Mind you, I graduated from law school in 2003, so this is not distant memory, although that was 20 years ago. For not wearing a skirt. I don't believe that many women, even if you are a senator, would feel comfortable and as if they are just as empowered or being seen on equal footing with Mr. Fetterman if they wore the same clothes. So it's not just about an acknowledgement of respect for the chamber and the work that you're doing. I think that applies, but each person should be able to adjust how they think they best embody that respect. John Fetterman ran as one of the regular people. His clothing and the way that he carried himself matched that brand. But that doesn't make the measure of the man. But notice the phrase is the measure of the man. Women and people of color simply don't enjoy that privilege. And it is a privilege to dress like a slob when you go to work. It was in the tech industry that business casual and wearing jeans and t-shirts and tennies, and that's where that came up from before the dot-com bubble burst. Well, what's that industry dominated by? Men, and mostly white guys, and mostly rich white guys. So my point to you is this. Love him, hate him, think Fetterman's great or not. Think a dress code's appropriate or not. But remember this. Whatever the dressing standards are, women and people of color have to meet or exceed those in order to be respected in the same way that white men are. Facts, ladies and gentlemen. facts. You disagree, you call me up because I'd love to debate me this one. 844-967-2789. When we come back from break, we're going to move on to a little bit more grab bag.
No matter where I turn, I got the carrots load. Wish you shine, brother, thinks I'm so naive.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, and I am Maggie Dunn. We're talking about a grab bag of things this afternoon. If you want to weigh in on the sentence change to dress code, you can call or text us 844-967-2789. I think we have just about solved the call problem, yes or not yet. So text if you've got questions or comments on that, or questions about what is going on with the Megan Wolf sitch and the state Senate. 844-967-2789. It wouldn't be a triumphant return to radio for me if we didn't have a couple of technical hurdles to jump over. But hey, we're rolling with it. My take, if you didn't catch it, is dress codes that are relaxed pretty much work for men really well. They work less well for women. That's just the scoop. They work less well for people of color. I thought it was pretty funny. Susan Collins, who's a Republican senator from Maine, suggested that she would now be showing up in bikinis. Yeah, cute, Susan, but not quite. I'm trying to envision a universe in which a woman would feel empowered to show up on the Senate floor, a senator who's a female, in like her yoga clothes. Can you envision it? I just can't. And the reason is, like, women don't have that latitude. It's just those aren't equally beneficial dress code relaxations, I shall say. In case you're wondering, yeah, I'm the boss of a department. Yes, I do set a dress code for my staff. And guess what I've done with that? I've basically never said anything about it. And when we went to a full hybrid work schedule and we had returned to the office, I said to people, if you don't have a meeting, if you don't with a client, if you're not meeting with key stakeholders, you're not face-to-face, if it's all just internal stuff, you can wear your jeans to work, for crying out loud. Lord knows I like it when I don't have to get all gussied up. And I hope to, quote, set the pace for that. I fully embrace wearing my jeans and casual clothes to work when I don't have a series of in-person meetings with key stakeholders and clients. Texter is sharing with us this great adage. I was taught to dress for the job you want, not the dress you have. Take that as you will. The jackets and blazers can go, a shirt and a tie, mostly needed. Women, I am jealous. You have so many options to look good. I really am. I personally wear a kilt very often. I wouldn't be allowed to be on the floor as a representative. That is awesome. Thanks for that input. Yes, women have more options, but let me assure you this. It is both burden and blessing. You ask why women have a lot of pairs of shoes? I'll tell you, because we need them. We can't get away with a pair of flip-flops or gym shoes, brown dress shoes, and black dress shoes. We got to do a lot more than that because our wardrobes are much larger than that. I could spend an entire hour regaling everyone with the fact that, unlike men, no women can walk into a women clothing store and say, I wear a 32 long, and you pull it off the rack and it absolutely will fit. Women's body types have such great variation, and the way that fashion has evolved over literally centuries has, especially in modern times, required that women's clothing is a bit more form-fitting. As a general rule, that's what's perceived as looking nice, even in a professional setting. And women simply don't have really well-fitting clothes. If you want your clothes to fit really well, women, and especially if you're not within the Missy size range, and 80% of U.S. women or not. You almost have to get your stuff tailored. It costs a fortune to dress well, to dress professionally as a woman. Men can get away with one good blue suit, a couple of decent pairs of khaki pants, and a gray suit and call it a day. Women, yeah, not so lucky. The other thing I wanted to talk about today, and listen, if you're trying to call or text, keep coming. We will get there for you. I appreciate the input that's coming in. Here's what I wanted to talk about next. Did anybody listen to Merrick Garland testimony today? Anybody out there? 844-967-2789. Because while I was getting ready, and yes, we're trying to take calls. If you've got questions or comments, send them in via text, but you can also try to give Anya a call, 844-967-2789. Are we able to take the callers yet? Maybe. So give it a shot. If you can't get through and I can't take you, we will read your text off, 844-967-2789. Merrick Garland today. What grade do you give Merrick Garland's performance today before an absolutely rowdy, rowdy House Judiciary Committee? I'm going to give him a C minus. Calls should work now. We're getting the thumbs up. So ring them up, folks. 844-967-2789. You want to talk about Senate dress codes. You want to talk about how unequal dress codes work for women, people of color, and white men. Call us up. You want to talk about Merrick Garland's performance and offer your thoughts on what grade he gets for today. Call me up. 844-967-2789. He gets a C minus. It was like the man had never argued in court before. He seemed like he was surprised by the questions coming his way. I would have had Jack Smith's resume and Attorney Weiss's resume, the two special counsels, like, on the ready. Here are their records. No, these weren't partisan picks. No, these aren't partisan lawyers. He just didn't seem prepared to engage in that kind of back and forth. I put Merrick Garland up next to Bill Barr. Now, I disagree with everything, almost everything Bill Barr says, but I give Bill Barr like A pluses on his performance in front of congressional and Senate committees. The guy is kind of a jerk about it, but he appears with authoritativeness and he engages the topic with his questioners. There are certain things, of course, that Merrick Garland can't say, which is fine, but you still have to engage in the discussion. The bit of it that I watched just did not wear well. And of course, Republicans have their talking points and things, but shouldn't you be prepared for those? And shouldn't it be fair to expect that the Attorney General, who is a long-sitting D.C. appellate court judge, that you can put on a better performance? I mean, politics is performance art. I've talked about politics being theater. You got to be prepared for those moments, buddy. Who's the communications guy for the Attorney General's office? That guy should get fired. It was a terrible performance today. C minus, barely passing. He stayed on message, and that was about it. Mark from the SAC, you're on the Maggie Don Show. Welcome back, my friend.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for yesterday. That it's pretty clear to me that reading, I went and read the statute 940, 13, 15, and 16. That under the language here, it looks like, you know, abortion is still legal in the state of Wisconsin. It might be inaccessible to a lot of women here in the state of Wisconsin because, you know, the physicians are still going to be afraid to do it, but it's still accessible. I mean, a personal story. It wasn't me personally, but I can remember meeting a young woman coming back from Superior, Wisconsin, riding the bus. I think she picked it up in Eau Claire, that I think she had been to the cities. I don't even know if abortion was legal in Wisconsin. There was a clinic available to women in Wisconsin in 1981. And she needed somebody to talk to. I just happened to be sitting next to her. And she, you know, told me her story, and I just that in a long, lonely trip for that poor young woman, by herself, and that to get a service that should have been available to her in the community where she lived. And that has stuck with me, you know, for 40 years now.
Yeah. Those moments when, if you know someone or even run into someone, thanks, Mark, for the call, their watershed. I have had very close female friends in my life that have needed to access the full range of women's healthcare options. I cannot stand in judgment. I can't. And I frankly don't think that there's anything to judge. I'll share this story, and I may have shared it on the air before, but I think this is, to Mark's point, this is really important. And it's interesting because my two other stories, my grab bag for today, are also abortion related. So thanks for setting this back up, Mark. But before I get to those two next stories, let me just share this. When I was just out of law school, I was clerking for a federal appeals court judge on the Seventh Circuit. He just passed away this year. His name was Michael Caney. Really nice man. He asked his clerks to live in Lafayette, Indiana. And at the time, I had a boyfriend that I had been seeing for a while living in Lafayette, Indiana. We had a birth control failure. So at the time, Plan B was prescription only. So I called my obstetrician and my gynecologist. I shouldn't say my OBGYN. I wasn't pregnant. My gynecologist the next day. And I certainly didn't want to be. So I called her and said, I had a birth control failure. Can you write me a script for Plan B? She said, sure. Asked me, as they usually do, what's your preferred pharmacy? I told her the Walgreens down the block. Great. Finished my workday. Went to Walgreens. Now the doctor's office is closed. I'm at the counter in Walgreens. I say, you have a prescription for Maggie Dawn. She goes back there. She comes back and she's like, can you just wait a moment? The pharmacist needs to speak with you. And I was like, for what? Are there some side effects I don't know about? Otherwise, can I have my drugs so I can go home? And it was about like 6:30 or 7, somewhere around there. And the pharmacist comes up and he's looking at me and he's like, young lady, I was 24. Young lady, do you know what this is? And I said, yes. And he started to basically give me a hard time about it. He's like, I don't think I'm comfortable filling this prescription. And you all will not be surprised at what happened next. I leaned over that counter. I looked at this man in the face and I said, sir, I don't know if you know who I am, but I am a lawyer and I work for a federal appeals court judge, and you do not have the right to decline to fill this prescription for me. And even if you did, please make note that I will be calling the Lafayette Tribune and the Better Business Bureau here in Indiana and reporting you. Because as you well know, sir, Plan B's effectiveness decreases the later I have to wait to take it. My doctor's office is closed right now, so you, sir, are now putting my health at risk. I would really prefer it if you just processed the transaction and handed me the prescription that my doctor wrote for me. And he looked at me and rung me up and handed over my Plan B. Now, that is a story about Plan B not accessing an abortion. And I often think of that and the trauma that is endured by women who are simply trying to access healthcare that should be their inalienable right to access, and the crap and flack women have to deal with. And what would a woman of 18 that didn't come from the privileged background that I was so fortunate to come from, who didn't have a law degree, who didn't work for a federal appeals court judge, who didn't have that confidence, who didn't grow up with a little bit of a chip on her shoulder about the man, capital T, capital M. What is that young lady going to do? What if she was black? What if she was poor? What if she was someone you loved and she got stared down and somebody attempted to intimidate her? What if I ended up pregnant? What if she ended up pregnant because of that man's judgment of me, which he had no right to make? Those stories are legion and they continue to this day. When we come back, I'm going to wrap up today by talking about two other grab bag stories, both of which have to relate to this ongoing abortion debate, so important in America today and so essential to the 2024 election cycle. If you want to join our discussion, you are always welcome. 844-967-2789. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Remember, you can always listen wherever you go with the free Civic Media app. Go get it from the Google Play or App Store. Also, guess what? The Brewers just started another game. Wonderful. Let's hope they notch another W against those dreaded St. Louis Cardinals. You can listen to Brewers games on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the app, any of WJRN, WRCE, or WISS. So check that out, everybody. And let's not forget, I'm going to be joined October 2nd by my good friend Matt Salmon. We're going to talk everything Brewers postseason as well as the stadium debate. You don't want to miss it. Later that week, I will have Bob DeVita back explaining why healthcare is so screwed up in the U.S. But I'm most excited to announce that next Thursday, I will not be here. That's not what I'm excited about. I will not be here. But what I am excited about is that Anastasia will be the guest host for my show. I am so thrilled, so excited, and so humbled that you have agreed to do this, Anya. My thanks to you. So you don't want to miss Anya telling it straight to you about what you want
to
hear.
Leave it got to a couple me of... to not be listening when you announce my show. I was screening a call, but yeah, watch my show, please. It might be okay.
Yeah. Watch and listen. You can hear it direct from Anya, her scoop on everything. We got a couple of callers. Let's go to Annie. Annie, you are on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you, my friend?
For years, I had the story to tell young women about how crazy things were. When I was back home after college working, I remember I took home $96 a week. A birth control prescription per month was $35. Plus, my doctor would not prescribe them. He was a strict Catholic, and it was like totally, if you wanted birth control, he'd have to refer you to a different doctor.
Refer you to a different doctor. Yep.
But I forget if it was a cyst or endometriosis, whatever, but he prescribed birth control pills to take care of this problem. And I could not get it covered by insurance because they don't cover birth control pills. Even though I went round and round with the insurance company, no, they wouldn't. I mean, like, wasn't that just crazy?
It's insane. Thanks so much for sharing your story, Annie, and doing so bravely. I applaud you and your commitment to your health to go get the medical help that you needed. It's really, I mean, that's the reality, folks. Women have sex outside of marriage, and women deserve to control when they get pregnant and when they have children. That's the facts. Men do not have to share in that risk in an equal way with women. So I really don't think men should be dictating to women how to solve those problems. That simple. And oh, by the way, I don't care what your religion is because we live in a secular democracy. So the two things I wanted to make y'all aware of this afternoon before we run out of time, and thanks everybody for texting. Jim from Appleton, I just have to call this one out. Jim's offering that maybe it was a good thing that Merrick Garland didn't make it to the Supreme Court. I'd offer that that's probably the better place for him. You don't see a lot of Supreme Court justices appearing before Congress and engaging in vigorous back and forth exchanges read Clarence Thomas, read Samuel Alito, right? Except for their confirmation hearings, which are much more constrained than what was going on today. L.A. Tom, he gives Merrick Garland a C. I'm glad I've convinced folks to take a little bit of a cynical view there, because I just don't think it was a decent performance today. Here are the two abortion-related stories that I wanted to touch on. First, I'm sure everybody has been in tune with this, and that is that Donald Trump, who packed the court with a bunch of far-right, uber-religious Supreme Court justices that now have removed women's inalienable privacy right to obtain health care that they need with consultation and comfort provided by their doctors. He's backtracking. He got on Meet the Press this past Sunday and basically said, this really is about trying to find a space to negotiate. That's his position. He called Ron DeSantis' 6-week abortion ban terrible. And he said, you know, this Dobbs decision, that's just to create negotiating space so that pro-choice and pro-life people can effectively find the right number of weeks or months after which abortion should be illegal. I mean, what? What? That's bananas. Like, that's not the contours of the argument. This isn't about settling it, like horse trading a real estate deal, Donald. I mean, his entire construction of this debate is in and of itself offensive. And by the way, a recent Economist YouGov poll, this was taken in January, found that 67% of Republicans want abortion to be completely or mostly illegal. Illegal, 67% of them. So who is it? Why is Trump saying this? Because of suburban women in Wisconsin. That's why. Suburban women in Wisconsin, suburban women in Pennsylvania, college-educated, married, suburban women. He can't win Wisconsin, especially without them. It is a pure, naked, transactional position. Evangelicals, there's your guy. Do you stand on principle, or has this all been a bunch of smoke and mirrors and gaslighting of a country? And it's never really been about morality or ethics or family values or any of that nonsense. You just use that to take money from people so that you can enjoy power. That's what I think it's really about. The other incredible story that broke yesterday is that Ohio, you'll remember this. Remember Ohio tried to change the constitutional percentage requirement for an amendment to their constitution? It was at 50% and they wanted to make it 60, but that was rejected. So guess what they did? The Ohio Republican Party, because there's a referendum coming up to enshrine abortion rights in the Ohio Constitution, the good old GOP rewrote the referendum question to be totally confusing. Is anyone surprised by that? They don't really want us to understand what it is that we're voting for. How despicable. You can't even let the vote go straight up and down on it. You got to try to trick people into not voting to support women's health care. That's it for today, everybody. I will be back tomorrow. Don't forget, my good friend Colleen Foley will be on Thursday with me, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there. You've been listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.